Our next case is a consolidated appeal A21-1293 in the matter of the welfare of the child of JT and CW parents and A21-1295 in the matter of the welfare of the child of SB and JT. And each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with 5 minutes reserved for Mr. Mack if he decides he wants to use it. This hearing is being recorded and will be posted on the court's website within a day or two, I think. And so, like if we were in at the MJC, no recording is allowed. And would each of you please state your name before you begin your argument? And with that, attorney for appellant.
John Mack, attorney for appellant. I want to make sure I leave time for the second part of my argument because I think that's of statewide importance. But starting with the first part of my argument, the district court improperly ruled against appellant before he could present his case. Rule 49-02 sub 2A gives a party a right to present evidence, to present witnesses, to present arguments in support of or against the statutory grounds set forth in the petition. The district court did not allow us to do any of these things. Rule 49.02 sub 2B of the Juvenile Protection Rules sets forth the following procedures. Subdivision 4, the other parties, in order determined by the court, may offer evidence. Judge didn't let us do that. Sub 6 says the other parties, in order determined by the court, may offer evidence in rebuttal. We never got to the rebuttal stage. Therefore, we were denied under the rule, the right to present evidence. The district court failed to meet these requirements. So even if the appellant's testimony foreclosed him from arguing that he was presently unable to care for the children by himself, that did not foreclose him from presenting evidence. First of all, if his argument of indirect parental care is—
Mr. Mack, did you make an offer of proof at the time as to what evidence you would like to have presented?
We did not at the time, but I think I did introduce the two affidavits from the grandparents indicating what proof they would have done. And that is attached to my record, yes.
And I was going to ask you about that. I'm sorry.
Go right ahead. Go ahead, Judge Riley. I think we're on the same page.
But the grandparents weren't parties or interveners in this trial, this CHIPS proceeding. So what rights did they have to present their evidence?
Well, first they had the right under Rule 49 because it says they have that right. Second, they have the right under the Constitution to present evidence because if they aren't—
Well, your client may have been able to present whatever testimony they would say, but I don't know that the grandparents were parties or interveners in this proceeding.
The grandparents were granted the right of parties. Furthermore, they were potential witnesses, and I would have called them as part of my case.
And I'm sorry, Judge Conley, I interrupted you.
Where, can you hear me? Yes. Where, in response to the question you just answered, Mr. Mack, where in the record would I find that they were made parties?
I think in the judge's order, previous order, that he indicated that they could become parties and that they became parties and that they had the rights of parties. So if you look at the judge's order prior to this hearing, you'll see that he explicitly indicated that they were parties.
Okay, and we'll certainly check that out. And then to my second question is, what is the evidence that you would have liked to present specifically related to the parents' affidavit?
Well, I would have presented what the parents said in their affidavit. I would have presented evidence that the children were doing just fine.
I've got to stop you just so I'm clear. You said parents. Do you mean your client's parents? You meant, because we have two sets of parents or three or four sets of parents. So let's refer to your client's parents as grandparents.
Okay, will do. And they would have presented evidence in accordance with their affidavit. I would have called them as witnesses, and they would have testified that the kids were doing just fine in their care.
Okay.
Even if my clients—
But that would not have rebutted the basic point that that your client, due to his addiction issues, could not parent. So it would have gone not to that issue, it would have gone to the other issue, which is, as you pointed out, they're doing just fine with the grandparents, and then that goes to your issue about custody. But it would not have refuted the addiction issue. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Mack?
That's a fair statement, but of course.
And then on that point, since there were two grounds for termination.
Not termination, Your Honor.
Excuse me, I apologize. You're absolutely right. Not termination. There are two grounds for CHIPS. You know, and as best as I can tell, you've challenged one but not the other, which may indeed have merit. Why couldn't we just affirm as to the other subdivision relating to the CHIPS? Because the district court found two grounds.
I challenged both of them. And one of them relates to the deficiency of the child. And there's absolutely no evidence of a deficiency on the part of the child. So the deficiency on the part of the parent is...
I'm not sure what you mean, deficiency on the part of the child.
Well, if we look at the other subdivision, it indicates that the child himself has a problem in that the child is deficient, the child has a problem, and so forth. I think that this is subdivision 9. And I mentioned that briefly because I don't think that's even close. I think everything under 260C 0007 relates to subdivision 6-8. The child is without proper parental care because of the state of the child's custodian. Now, if my client's argument about indirect parental care is correct, he was prepared to testify and offer evidence that the children were receiving good parental care.
Well, I think part of the issue, and I'm looking at your addendum, page 40, which is the CHIPS petition. And it seems to me that what brought this to head is that the mother of the youngest child was concerned, rightly or wrongly, about possible sexual abuse of that little girl and was taking her all over to try to get an assault exam. And the child ended up at Children's in St. Paul. And Children's in St. Paul was not going to let the biological mother take her because your client was the one who had a court order saying he was the custodial parent. And then when they tried to reach both your client and his mother, they weren't able to. And so here's this little girl the medical authorities are ready to release her to a proper person. They can't find anyone. And so she's put on a police hold, as I understand the records in your addendum.
Here's the problem. We were going to offer issue evidence on that issue, and we were precluded from doing it because the court ruled as if this were a summary judgment case. That's one of the reasons why we should have been able to testify as to exactly that issue.
Once again, to Judge Conley's point, was there an offer of proof for us to review?
And the answer to that is, first, there are the affidavits. Second, we don't have to make an offer of proof in a case where the issue before the judge was whether or not he should simply make a determination based upon what the parent testified to should be foreclosed from offering evidence further. And the other issue I want to bring up before I get into what I think is a real issue in this case is the county knows that because it made its motion in its favor, it also put the guardian ad litem on the stand to prove best interests. We have a right to refute that. Best interests case is admissible evidence, but it's not irrefutable evidence. And we should have been able to put people on the stand to say that it was in the best interest of the child that the present custodial arrangement prevailed.
Well, how do you respond to the older child? It's tribes don't just willy-nilly give qualified expert testimony. And we have the affidavit of the expert in this case regarding out-of-home placement.
You have an affidavit, but the problem is that can be refuted. And secondly, the expert in this case, it's interesting that the older child is now living with the grandparents. The older child is also an ICWA child. And therefore, much of the evidence that was in the affidavit would have to be proved. It wasn't proved. It's the sort of thing that would have to be proved in testimony, and it wasn't testified to. Now I want to go to the issue of indirect parental care as proper parental care. First, the grandparents are custodians within the meaning of Minnesota Statute 260C-00007 subdivision 10, because a person who is in fact providing care and support for a minor is in fact a custodian within the meaning of that statute. Now consider 260C-00007 sub 6-8, that the child is without proper parental care because of the state of the immaturity of the child's custodian. Well, the child's custodian is the grandparents. The child custodian are not problematical and they're not immature. The appellant's deficiencies did not cause the child to be without proper.
I mean, I understand the grandparents are, but wasn't there evidence in the record that sometimes they would let the father take care of the children so that they were not always with the grandparents?
This is true. And this is probably in the parents.
Well, to sort of be blunt, even if if your client, who admittedly has an addiction and couldn't take care of the children, which is why the grandparents were taking care of them, and I understand the argument, were custodians, doesn't it go to their judgment as custodians that they're letting the children at any time be with your client who has an addiction overnight? I mean, that would seem to be, we wouldn't let foster parents do that under court jurisdiction. I guess, why would that not show that they were not good custodians?
That goes to the weight of the evidence and not to the legal argument in this case. We don't know whether when the grandparents allowed the parents to parent the child, whether this person's addiction caused him to drink much or not, or whether he was sober when he had the children, whether he was a good parent when we had the children. That requires evidence, and evidence requires a trial. So the children were not without proper parental care, or at least we were not afforded the opportunity to present evidence that they were. As I say, the Trulian grandparents were custodians.
So Mr. Mack, it is a curious procedural posture. I don't think I've ever seen a case quite like this one. Did the county rest and say, we think we've proved it up and we think you can issue your order now granting our petition? Or how did it happen? I couldn't tell from reading the trial transcript.
Well, it's weird. Here's what happened. The county, after they presented their two witnesses, or the three witnesses, moved by motion that the court should make a finding in this case that there was chips against my client. If the judge had determined against the county in this case, in all probability, the state would have continued, or the county would have continued to present its witnesses. And at that point, we would have presented our witnesses in rebuttal to the county's case. But this case was decided on motion, and the judge analogized this to a summary judgment motion. Now, the problem with that in a summary judgment motion, at least the non-responding party has a right to submit everything that it has in its affidavits. In this case, that didn't happen because we weren't able to present our evidence. It seems to me that the case of LF is of extreme importance. Unfortunately, it's an unpublished case. If it had been published, it would have been decisive. That's why I think this is an important case, because I think the issue of indirect parental care is statewide. But here's what JF says. If the circumstances of LH not personally providing all of JF's care, instead allowing the DOPA delegate and alleged father to share in the caretaking promptly, prompted the county to file a CHIPS petition. We're concerned that such action might discourage other similarly situated parents from signing DOPAs. This discouragement will not advance the best interests of similarly situated children. Now, in this case, the grandparents had a DOPA.
But Mr. Eck, in LF, there was a valid DOPA in place, and you've admitted there wasn't a valid DOPA in place in this case. Is that a fair statement?
It would have taken 4 minutes and 33 seconds for a DOPA to be signed in this case.
Well, I agree, but you know, it wasn't, and so that. I mean, I just think that makes it a different case.
I don't think it does, because if the parents had been allowed to make a DOPA, if the county had said, hey, why don't you renew your DOPA, none of this would have happened.
May I ask, Annette, was there something preventing it? You said if the county had allowed it, was that not doable without the county's permission at that time?
Yeah, but if the county had said to my people, why don't you make another DOPA? They would have done it. And the children would not have been subject to CHIPS, at least with relevant fathers.
Thank you. I see that your time is up. Do either of my colleagues have any more questions before we turn to respondent?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Juliana Passy on behalf of Candiwai County Health and Human Services. Your Honors, the CHIPS petition in this matter was based on one undisputed fact, that the father is not able to care for his children at this time. Father testified to this, and that is what the district court relied on in appropriately determining that there was no dispute that the children should be adjudicated as CHIPS based on father's admission, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in adjudicating the children as such, and the county would-
Ms. Passy, if in a murder trial, the defendant gets on the stand and says, you know what, I did kill her, the trial's over, is that the way it works?
Typically, no, Your Honor. And I would agree that this is a strange procedural posture that we have going on here. I disagree slightly with Mr. Mack's characterization of the record. If you review the transcript-
On that point, Ms. Passy, you know, were the grandparents parties or not?
It is my reading of the record, Your Honor, that they did intervene in the case over the summer.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. With regard to how the district court decided to end the trial proceedings early, there appears to be an in-chambers discussion at some point. When the parties return and go back on the record after the in-chambers discussion, it is clear that the parties are contemplating and have discussed with the court whether or not to end the proceedings at that time based on the father's admission. It is not clear from the record who, whether it was the county or one of the other parents or the guardian ad litem who brought that motion. Regardless, it is clear from the record, and I'd cite Your Honor the transcript at page 144, that the county had not rested its case. It specifically requested the opportunity to reopen the record in the event that the district court ruled against it on the CHIPS motion. Mm-hmm. Back to your question, Judge Connolly, I would agree this is a strange procedural posture. It's my understanding that the district court did this in the interest of expediency and lack of court time. However, and this is not a typical procedural posture. However, the county's position is that the appellant cannot show any prejudice from the termination of the trial proceedings mid-trial in light of the father's admission in this case.
And I want to go to the definition of custodian that Mr. Mack recited. And it's clear that the grandparents weren't under a legal obligation because they didn't have a valid DOPA at the time, but it's or who is in fact providing care and support for a minor. And so my reading of the record is that the father and the grandparents could have provided testimony and evidence that the grandparents were indeed providing care and support for the two minors. How do you respond to that?
Well, the issue, Your Honor, the CHIPS ground, which were the district court did find two grounds, subdivision 8 and subdivision 9. The one we're mostly arguing about today is subdivision 8, about what constitutes proper parental care. And the district court's reading of proper parental care is that proper parental care must be care provided by a parent. It is undisputed that the grandparents are not a parent within the meaning of the statute.
But they are, to follow up on Judge Riley's question, could be an other custodian. The children were with the grandparents. So why? I mean, I think Mr. Mack has a valid point on that.
I think the issue for this court really boils down to what is proper parental care under the statute. I would argue that the parental care needs to be construed consistently with the definition of parents under subdivision 25 of the same statute, which defines parent as a person who has a legal parent and child relationship with the child, which confers or imposes on the person legal rights, privileges, duties, and obligations. I think also that reading of the statute makes sense in that a child could be, a parent could be providing improper parental care by entrusting the care of the child to a custodian or someone who's providing care for the child, but that person themselves is not a fit person to care for the child.
How would we know that, since presumably Mr. Mack wanted to bring the grandparents in to show how they were doing such a great job, and the court didn't allow that? I mean, that's troubling to me as to subdivision 8.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, that the allowing the county's argument, Your Honor, is that the father himself was not providing parental care, and it doesn't matter. You cannot give all of your responsibilities to a third party who doesn't have any kind of legal obligation to care for the child.
My God, in juvenile court, the first thing we did was, so are the grandparents an option? I mean, we're always looking to the grandparents to raise the grandchildren if the parents can't do it because of addiction or whatever. So, I mean, I think it would be a stretch to somehow say, because they're not, the parental care cannot be provided by grandparents who could be an other custodian. I agree, there's no DOPA, which, is a problem, but I'm not so sure about that. But I guess my last question, Ms. Bessie, before I'll stop interrupting you, do we have to get to any of this, since it doesn't appear that the subdivision 6-9 has been challenged?
Your Honor, I would agree with, I don't know if it was Your Honor or someone else who had indicated that there doesn't appear to be a challenge in Mr. Mack's brief to the subdivision 9 part. I would agree that is my reading of appellant's brief in this matter. So I would argue that the court does not have to reach the subdivision 8 grounds. But I'm talking about it since obviously the court could disagree.
Well, it looks like the reasoning for subdivision 9 is essentially the same as the reasoning for subdivision 8, that there was not, right, the district court's reasoning.
I would agree that the district court's reasoning appears to be the same for both grounds, that the district court viewed the entrusting of the child to the grandparents without creating any kind of legal rights for the grandparents, any obligations, any ability for the grandparents to bring the child in to get medical care, make decisions about their schooling, things like that, was concerning to the district court.
Because there wasn't testimony about the environment itself being, the actual environment of the grandparents' home being dangerous.
There was some,
or was there
limited testimony, Your Honor? There, I don't think it was fully developed in the record because of the posture of the case, but there was some record evidence about concerns that the grandparents were permitting the father to be using chemicals in their home while the children were present. So there is some indication in the record of that. And of course, the county's witness list clearly indicates that it had planned to provide additional evidence on that, but didn't because of the court's decision to end the testimony.
Ms. Solis got to testify.
That's correct.
And it sounds like she and Dad were staying at the grandparents' house regularly during the summer. Her testimony was very confusing.
Her testimony, Your Honor, is that she and father were staying together at parts at the, or she was going to the home of the grandparents, and that they had used chemicals, methamphetamine, in the grandparents' house at that time.
But unfortunately, the judge, even though he heard that testimony, didn't make any credibility findings on that or mention that, I don't think, in his order.
Not that I recall at this moment, Your Honor. I could be wrong about that.
Doesn't Ms. Pesce, for the CHIPS adjudication under subdivision 9, there we don't have the custody issue. And since there's no DOPA, I mean, isn't that a problem then for the appellant under subdivision 9?
I would agree, Your Honor, that there is evidence in the record that the environment which the children were in, regardless of whether or not father was at the house or, you know, just intermittently coming, that there were conditions at the home that were dangerous to the children in light of the testimony of Ms. Delise. And I believe potentially, I think there were some indications of others that there was use of chemicals at the home. So I would agree that if the court determines that there is sufficient grounds on number 9, that we could sidestep the whole parental care.
The whole issue under subdivision 8 is the grandparents were doing a good job and they had custody. The problem under subdivision 9 for the appellant, as I read it, is, he admitted he has an addiction problem, and the weight of and under subdivision 9, that's enough, and it doesn't matter whether the children were in the grandparents' custody, legal or otherwise, or not. I mean, am I following, or does that make sense to you, Ms. Pesce?
I think it does, Your Honor, in that it's the behavior, condition, or environment of the child, you know, is injurious or dangerous to the child or others. I mean, certainly there is record evidence that father is addicted to chemicals. He's frequently using chemicals. I think that there's indication of significant use of methamphetamine as well as alcohol and other drugs. So to the extent, there's obviously record evidence that father was having at that time, at least, contact with the children, and that he is an active user of controlled substances. So I would say that that is sufficient under subdivision 9.
And then can I just, on subdivision 8, so to understand how you read the statute, I just want to make sure I understand it, is that custodian, while custodian has two definitions in the definition of custodian, one who has is under a legal obligation, or just one who is in fact providing care. You're saying for purposes of subdivision 8, it's only the legal custodian, only the custodian has a legal obligation to provide full parental care. In other words, that's the only meaning of custodian there, because they have to be able to provide parental duties, so they need to have legal authority to provide the parental duties. Is that right?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And I would note that the definition of custodian in subdivision 10, you know, it refers to the legal obligation to provide, or who is in fact providing care and support. And then it goes on to say the subdivision does not impose upon persons who are not otherwise legally responsible for providing a child with necessary food, clothing, shelter, education, or medical care a duty to provide that care. So I don't think, you know, merely that subdivision itself is saying, you know, it's not going to provide, just because you might be providing care doesn't mean that's creating a legal duty for you to care for the child. I wondered, and
maybe you don't, this might be unfair of a question, which I appreciate, but I wondered if for subdivision 8, custodian only meant the first thing, is there somewhere else in the statute where the second meaning of custodian is a relevant term? But maybe that's something that I can't fairly ask you off the bat, because otherwise I'd be wondering, well, why do we even have that second?
Yeah, Your Honor, I did look into that question when I was writing my brief, and I did find other parts in chapter 260C, where they are using, you know, custodian in different frames. I can't tell you off the top of my head right now, but it did, you know, there's, it's not just obviously this part of the statute, you know, the definition section is applies to the whole chapter. So I did find sections there where it appeared to make sense to me that there would be reasons to have this kind of this dual meaning for what custodian means.
I mean, one reason would be, you know, parents who are having problems don't always go through the legal niceties, and maybe they would find just some friend to take care of the children. And so then it gets the issue is, okay, well, maybe those people don't have legal custody of the children, but they're taking care of the children, and they might be doing a horrible job too. I mean, they also might be drug addicts. So maybe that's how I read why that other custodian is there, because whoever has physical custody of the child, whether legally or not legally, is also a mess. And therefore the county has to step in to do something. And that I know for a fact, I mean, does happen. I mean, you know, people, you know, if they're having issues, you know, I mean, they maybe rather choose their best friend than a family member, but, you know, sometimes their friends are not the greatest of friends either. So what, does that make sense?
I think that it does make some sense, Your Honor. And I think it also, you know, to me, I drag it back to what does proper parental care mean? And does proper parental care, you know, if I am a parent and I give custody of my child to this, you know, to my friend who is not capable because my friend is a sex offender or is a meth addict or whatnot.
But I mean, if the friend is actually, you know, the world's greatest mother in the history of the world, that and that's why while I have my addiction, I am giving it to that person, then I'd say they do have proper parental care because, you know, the custodian has no emotional, mental, or physical disabilities or is immature. Now, granted, because there's no proper legal work, there might be some issue as to whether the friend could transfer the kids from one school to another because maybe the child has special needs and should be in a different school. But I'm not so sure I disagree with Mr. Mack as to other custodian. So anyway, I'll stop talking there.
Okay. I'm seeing out of time. I would ask that the court affirm. Thank you for your questions.
Thank you. Mr. Mack, you have 5 minutes.
Would you please turn to page 6 of my original brief, where I say, and I'm quoting, the CHIPS petition sets out two grounds for holding that ST and CT are children in need of protection. Said child is in need of protection or services within the meaning of Minnesota statute section 260C0076 in that the child, subdivision 9 is child, by the way, is one whose behavior, condition, environment is such to be injurious or dangerous to the child or others. Little need be said about subdivision 9. Of course, the appellant and his parents have a right to offer testimony and attempt to show that the children's condition and environment is not injurious to the children. Refusing to let them address the claim violates an important principle of American law, Rule 2.6 of the Code of Judicial Conduct. Refusal to permit the respondents to put on their case violates this principle. So I did address subdivision 9. Furthermore, subdivision 9, as I read it, applies to a child who has a problem, not to a parent who has a problem. And because it's the child who has the problem, there is no evidence that either child is problematical with regard to their health or safety. So I think subdivision 9 is both refuted and is totally irrelevant.
But okay, let's follow that. I mean, your client has admitted he has an addiction that prohibits him from parenting. How is that not then provides a ground for CHIPS because of his addiction and can't parent? You know, they are one children whose behavior, condition, or environment is such as to be injurious or dangerous to the child or others. He's admitted he can't parent them.
Oh, he didn't admit he couldn't parent
them. I'm not sure about that, but I mean, I disagree with you. I think subdivision 9 has been met based on your client's testimony. It doesn't matter whether the children were in the custody, were physically with him or his grandparents, or I'm sorry, his parents.
Well, I'm not sure whether that shows any problem on the part of the child, because their behavior isn't a problem. Their condition isn't a problem because the grandparents are doing just fine, or at least we could try to prove it. And finally, that their environment is injurious. And we had a right to try to show that the environment wasn't injurious because they were doing just fine with the grandparents.
Well, there was testimony that the older child was smoking marijuana and drinking and doing some other things that some people would view as injurious to his health.
Yeah, but then we had a right to refute that. We had a right to call the child, we had the right to call the grandparents, and we had the right to say, no, this is wrong. So that there's testimony in that regard, but it's not irrefutable testimony. I want to bring up a couple of things that are important here. Even if we accept, Judge Connolly, your idea that subdivision 9 applies to this case, my client still has the right to present evidence that it is in the best interest of the child to continue the current custodial relationship, even if there's a grounds for the CHIPS. And as we indicated rather extensively in my brief, the best interest of the child has to be determined independently of the question of whether there's grounds for the CHIPS. And therefore, we have, since the state offered testimony on the part of the guardian ad litem with respect to the best interest of the child, we had a right to refute that. Granted, the evidence was admissible, but it doesn't mean it's irrefutable. And therefore, we had a right to put the witnesses, here the grandparents, on the stand. One further thing I'd like to say, because this is important. You have only 6 months between the removal of the children and the determination of the court. Now, we've already burned 4 months in this case. And the last thing we want to do is have a Court of Appeals decision come down in the middle of a TPR hearing. So I hope I'm not being too presumptuous to say that there's a need for speed here. Thank you.
Thank you. And as you know, Mr. Mack, we have 45 days to get our decision out, which is a long time, you may think, but half of our ordinary time.
Sure.
So thank you for your arguments, both of you. It's a really interesting legal issue, and we will get our opinion out within the statutory period.
Yes, and it was nice to see you, Ms. Passy. It was nice to see you, Mr. Mack.
Thank you, sir.
You too, Your Honor.
And that concludes the oral portion of our calendar. We now will move to conference on our non-oral cases.